Hello there. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the president gets ready to console two communities rocked by mass shootings over the weekend, some say his words ring hollow.
The president has blood on his hands, and no scripted press conference is going to be able to wipe that clean.
The U.S.-China trade war ramps up with no end in sight. Also ahead, pop star Ariana Grande is about to launch something that pleases the senses, but it is not music. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump will make a solemn pilgrimage later today to the sites of mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. 31 people were killed and more than 50 injured over a single bloody weekend. But the words he's offering to heal a divided nation will be complicated by his own anti-immigrant rhetoric, which mirrors language used by one of the shooters. Protesters made their feelings clear at a demonstration outside the White House on Monday. Vanita Gupta, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, spoke to the crowd.
Yesterday, Trump said that hate has no home here, but we know the truth. Hate has too many homes here in this country. And under this president, hate's primary residence is right here at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's right. He says hate has no home here as he openly incites violence against immigrants, communities of color, and religious minorities and other marginalized communities. He said we must unite against bigotry as he peddles lies that stoke rage and racism among his base.
Well, ahead of the Dayton visit, Mayor Nan Whaley said she hopes he's coming with the best intentions, but doesn't think that he has said the right thing so far.
Look, I'm disappointed with his remarks. I mean, I think they fell really short. He mentioned, like, gun issues one time. I think, you know, watching the president over the past few years on the issues of guns, he's been, I don't know if he knows what he believes, frankly.
Well, besides the president's rhetoric, there are loud calls for passing substantial gun legislation, which is in large part stalled because of resistance from Republicans who are now in control of the Senate. Republican Congressman Peter King says he's heard all the arguments against his gun control bill that did pass in the House, and he says they don't hold water.
The arguments you hear about it have really nothing to do with the bill. It's talking about people coming to your house and taking away your guns, not allowing people to buy guns. The only people who are affected at all are people who have a criminal record or have been adjudicated as mental patients. That's what we're talking about.
Well, a series of mass shootings in the U.S. have sparked renewed calls for Congress to pass legislation to prevent gun violence. While Democrats want the Senate to interrupt its five-week summer recess and return to Washington to address the matter immediately, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, has not acted on that request. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with Chris Brown, president of Brady, an organization that urges lawmakers around the country to pass new laws on gun ownership. And she opens by talking about what her organization sees as practical approaches.
The reality is this is far too common in America. We have almost as many mass shootings in 2019 as we have days. And the reality is the solutions to stop this kind of violence are right before us. Things like an assault weapons ban and high-capacity magazines. If you're focusing on Dayton and El Paso, there's a common theme here. One is inspired by hate, both of them. The second is assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. So at Brady, we're very straightforward about what we think the solutions are. We think we need to expand the Brady background check system. We need to have an assault weapons ban and high-capacity magazine restriction as the law of the land, in other words, a federal law like we had for 10 years that Congress allowed to sunset. And President Trump mentioned this in his speech today. We need extreme risk laws. Those are the laws that about 15 states have passed that allow law enforcement and family members to seek a court order to temporarily remove guns from individuals who are at risk of harm to themselves or others. We have an epidemic, so we need a multi-pronged approach, and we should start there.
There has long been an argument in the United States that because there's reference to the right to bear arms in the U.S. Constitution, in the Second Amendment, that creates a special situation And there are people who say that because of that constitutional, just it's a few short words, because of those words in the Constitution, it's not legal to regulate weapons and guns in any way. How do organizations like yours address that argument and sort of explain that there might be a middle ground between no regulation and some regulation?
Well, the Second Amendment, like all of the amendments to our Constitution, is not absolute. There's not a single constitutional scholar, there's not even a single member of the Supreme Court, living or dead, who would agree that the amendments in the Constitution are absolute and without limit. Even Antonin Scalia, in his opinions, including the Heller decision, noted the kinds of restrictions that might be appropriate with respect to guns. So we have to start there. It's not an unlimited right, and that's just clear and set forth in the Constitution. It's also helpful to remember it starts with a well-armed militia, and that's a big part of the interpretation. The kinds of things that I've talked about here, assault weapons bans, restrictions on high-capacity magazines, expansion of the Brady background check system, extreme risk laws. Those laws are in effect in many states across this country. And believe me, because the NRA exists, they are well litigated. Every court that's looked at this issue has upheld those kinds of measures as constitutional. And you only need go back to think about the restrictions in place even when the Second Amendment was adopted, in which reasonable restrictions were enforced, even inspections of individuals' homes to ensure that their guns were safely stored. So that's always been inherent as part of really the American experience, along with a notion that had existed for a very long time that I think we've strayed from, which is guns are a tool, but they also pose potential danger, both to the owner and those who live in the homes where the guns are. And so ultimately what we have to go back to, what we really want to talk about or should be talking about if we want to fix a lot of these problems, is what responsible gun ownership really looks like in this country. And what Brady is trying to do is really foster conversations to include gun owners and non-gun owners about the kind of America in which we want to live.
All right. That is Chris Brown, president of Brady, an organization urging lawmakers to pass new gun laws, speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson. Experts say there are different reasons for compelling someone to commit mass murders. President Trump Monday blamed violent video games and mental illness.
This is also a mental illness problem. If you look at both of these cases, this is mental illness. These are really people that are very, very seriously mentally ill.
But the American Psychiatric Association put out a statement saying that the overwhelming majority of people with mental illness are not violent and far more likely to be victims of violent crime than perpetrators. It said rhetoric that argues otherwise will further stigmatize and interfere with people accessing needed treatment. Joining us now to talk more about guns and mental health is Dr. Robert Trustman, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. What do you say about this claim about mental illness being a cause of these incidents?
There's a fair amount of data that certainly suggests that it's a minority of people with a mental illness who commit mass murders. And of those who do have a diagnosed mental illness, those with a psychotic disorder are a tiny minority of them. From everything I can gather, there seem to be multiple factors that contribute to who becomes a mass shooter. One is there's a sense of hopelessness in their life, so that if they end up dying, at least they will make some kind of marker statement in some fashion to give some context or meaning in how they see their lives. The other is the sense that society creates models of behavior, and our leaders create a context for what's acceptable and what's not. And civilization exists only to the degree that law exists and defines defines what is right and what's wrong. And so over these recent years, there are examples from around the world where being violent is acceptable. Seeing people as other, isolating them, demonizing them is more and more acceptable in a lot of contexts. And certainly jingoistic, nationalistic interpretations that exist in many countries, more and more so, including our own, seem to be something that allows that to occur. Another factor is the availability of a weapon. It's really hard to cause a mass murder with a knife, and it's obviously far easier to do so with an available weapon that is designed for killing, as an assault weapon. So when you put all of those different factors together, a sense of alienation, a sense of hopelessness, a decreased threshold that allows people to have extreme views and see them as acceptable, and you have access to extreme weapons that historically were limited to military engagements, you create an environment that makes it much, much easier for there to be mass shootings and mass murders.
The American Psychiatric Association said that blaming people with mental illness for this type of violence further stigmatizes and interferes with people accessing needed treatment. You agree with that?
I do. The access to guns, while it certainly increases the risk of murder, homicide, mass murder, by far, an order of magnitude greater, increases suicide risk. And many of these events, mass murders, frequently are impulsive. Impulsive is defined within a few days, or a trigger that occurs within a few hours. Some are indeed planned and very thoughtful, but that's not as common. Same thing certainly with suicide. It tends to be around an emotional crisis, and if there's an available device, and certainly guns are far more lethal than pills for overdose.
Do you think that talking about this in such a manner that placing some of the blame on mental health issues stigmatizes people that have issues with mental health and might deter them from getting help?
Yes, because to begin with, mental illness has historically been stigmatized. We are still learning the underlying biology that can predispose us to mental illness of different kinds. In the absence of a clear understanding, it's very easy to engage in magical thinking and fear, and stigma is an expression of that in our society and in many others. If someone is seen as being mentally ill, and that means in the same breath that they're at greater risk of killing someone, then you are not going to create environments that will be supportive and engaging for people with mental illness. You're going to be much more likely to think of them as criminals, as scary people. Given the knowledge we have, it's just inaccurate and dangerous because it isolates people.
What can people do to recover from either being witness to these horrific incidents or being a victim or a family member of someone who is a victim? How do you come through this after experiencing such a level of violence?
Psychotherapy works. Having access to a therapist who can appropriately engage you and support you in a differential way immediately afterwards, as well as in the weeks and months that follow, because the experience of profound trauma is processed by us differently over time. Initially, we tend to be more numb and afraid, and over time, we begin to experience what is now typically described as post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder, with more avoidance, loss of energy, nightmares, flashbacks, things that will significantly impair someone's ability to function well. And so it is not limited to those in war zones. It is highly common in people who are survivors of trauma such as mass shooting. So psychotherapy is extremely valuable. Additionally, for those with really severe symptoms, having either a primary care physician or a psychiatrist prescribe appropriate medication can help treat the symptoms and help to improve functional state. It won't empower people to overcome some of the thinking, but it will allow them to be more able to engage in treatment, in psychotherapy. Also, normalizing the experience that this isn't just an individual's response and their frailty that they should just tough it out and get over it and go on living. It is a normal human response to be compromised because of this kind of trauma. And in groups, in group therapy, people can begin to realize that others who have survived the experience have a lot of the same symptoms, and that kind of normalizing of the after effects makes it easy not to feel isolated, alienated, and alone.
All right, that's Dr. Robert Trestman. He is chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. Thanks for being with us. A day after the Trump administration labeled China a currency manipulator, President Trump Tuesday vowed to protect American farmers against China by signaling to provide further aid if needed. This after Chinese firms stopped agricultural purchases and Beijing threatened more tariffs on U.S. farm products. U.S. Director of National Economic, the Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, said Tuesday he sees no sign of a recession, but added that he sees China's economy crumbling.
The door is open for additional negotiations. We are planning for the Chinese team to come here in September.
Joining us now to discuss the economic implications here in the U.S. and globally is economist Jane Gawley, acting director at the Australian Center on China in the World. So thank you for being with us. Is Trump's latest commitment to provide aid to farmers help? Will it help advance this ongoing trade war, which appears to have no end in sight?
I don't see at all how this can help. The way that Trump's going about claiming to help the American farmers seems very, very odd indeed, and it's also raising the specter of a serious trade war that looks like there's no end in sight. Apart from the subsidies that he's offering to give to the farmers, which is, of course, is a kind of market intervention of exactly the kind that he accuses China of, the tariff war, of course, is causing China to react with tariffs back on American products, and agricultural products are the natural place for them to target.
It seems like basically it's just a standoff. Nobody's really willing to compromise. Do you see any compromise here yet?
It doesn't look like very much compromise at all, and I think it's worse than a standoff because it's escalated so much just in the last couple of days. I think Trump's decision to accuse China of currency manipulation is a particularly bad move. The U.S. has, you know, over the last 10 years or more, accused China of intervening in the renminbi market, you know, in order to keep it low. And yet the IMF has never once found China guilty of currency manipulation, and they're the ones that set the rules around that. But now what's so ironic is that Trump is accusing China of not intervening into the renminbi market when all of the market forces are actually pushing the renminbi down. And of course, we now know that it's gone down below the 7 mark, cracked 7, and that's causing a lot of anxiety. But that itself comes from the trade war. It comes from the tariffs and the consequences that that's had for the Chinese economy. There's a slowdown there. And that all puts market pressure on the renminbi to drop further. So to step in and accuse them of manipulating by not intervening just really doesn't make sense.
How detrimental do you think all of this is to both economies, the U.S. and China, and potentially the rest of the world?
Well, it's another great irony in all of this is that Trump thinks what he's doing is standing with American farmers and that it's all good for the American economy. He keeps celebrating the $300 billion worth of tariff revenue that's coming in. But that is a price that is ultimately paid by the American consumers. Producers are also suffering. I keep looking and thinking about the soybean farmers in particular. You know, at one stage, I think soybean that were exempted from the tariffs in the first place, but now China's moving to raise tariffs on those farmers as Trump keeps channeling money into them. It's state-owned enterprises, what they call soybean crushers. They're being directed not to buy from the U.S. Meanwhile, private Chinese firms are looking elsewhere for their purchases. I understand South American soybean farmers are doing extremely well at the moment, and some of them have even recently moved to Russia to grow soybeans to sell back into the Chinese market. None of these things are good for American soybean farmers, and therefore Trump needs to keep giving them money through a system that is increasingly interventionist, resembling more and more China's own economy and all of the problems that he's criticized them for in the past. Now, what this means for the global economy, it's pretty devastating. The Australian stock market took a huge hit as a reaction to the latest tensions, and the global economy is slowing. There's a lot of nervousness about what will happen next, and unfortunately, I can't see how anything positive is going to happen anytime soon.
If this is true, that this could really be detrimental to the U.S. economy as well as others worldwide. Do you think we're not seeing it, so we don't feel it yet, but we will feel it at some point?
I'm pretty sure there are a lot of Americans that are already feeling the pain of this trade war, and the farmers, again, are the main example of that. It probably takes longer for consumers to recognize the higher prices that they're paying on all of the goods that they've imported from China in the past, but I'm sure a lot of people are also sensing the increase in tensions. There are a huge number of Chinese Americans who are feeling all sorts of pain from what's happening, you know, not just on an economic level, but on a sort of emotional level as well. But the longer term implications for the United States are certainly not good, and I think they'll be hit harder than what will happen to the Chinese economy. They're playing a very long game there. Xi Jinping has plans through to 2049 to restore China's place in the global economy. It's almost certain to become the world's largest economy during that period. And I think that's, again, quite emotionally challenging for a lot of Americans. But if you recognize or accept that that's going to happen and look forward to a future where America isn't necessarily the largest and most powerful economy in the world, you probably need to start playing the game a little differently.
All right. That's economist Jane Golly. She's the acting director of the Australian Center on China in the World. Climate change will hit many African countries more severely than previous thought. According to a new report, researchers warned that rapid population growth means more and more people will be affected by extreme weather events across the continent in the coming years. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Farmers in the Faranah region in Guinea, West Africa, work the soil in preparation for seeding. The ground is dry and baked hard. The hoes and rakes kick up clouds of dust. It's the rainy season, but the skies are clear. The rain isn't falling. For rice farmers like Kulare Mohammed, that could spell disaster. He says that climate change has caused a shortage of rain, and we are not getting any rainfall. It is very difficult for us to farm, he says. We cannot plant our rice seeds because of the lack of rainfall. The report from Britain's Meteorological Office and Leeds University warns that climate change caused by the burning of fossil fuels will bring chaos to Africa, with bouts of severe drought and flooding. Elizabeth Kendon of the Meteorological Office is co-author of the research.
For the first time, we've run a very high-resolution climate model on par with the resolution that we typically use for weather forecasting. So this climate model is able to represent small-scale processes in the atmosphere with much greater realism. The small-scale processes are really important for how climate extremes might change over Africa.
Kendon says flash floods will become much more common across Africa.
We've found that those sort of events, which are typically, say, once every 30 years now, could be as frequent as once every 3 to 4 years in the future. And in terms of wet extremes, so heavy rainfall, we see changes across the whole of the continent. In terms of the dry extremes, particularly we find that Central and Western Africa is infected.
The World Meteorological Organization warned that the month of July this year saw record heat waves across the globe, a phenomenon that has, in its words, rewritten climate history books. Scientists say people in Africa will likely be among the hardest hit by climate change over the coming decades, with less capacity to deal with the impact. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. And accused Syrian IS fighters are starting to face justice. National Security Advisor John Bolton says new sanctions will allow the U.S. to target supporters of the Venezuelan government. The FBI opens a domestic terrorism case in the Gilroy mass shooting. And the long, powerful U.S. gun lobby is mired in a scandal and infighting. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Writer, editor, and teacher Toni Morrison has died at the age of 88 in New York after a brief illness. AP Entertainment correspondent Margie Sarzaletta has more.
Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1993, and she basked in that honor. She said in a 1998 Associated Press interview, she decided that winning was fabulous and no one was going to take it and make it into something else. Morrison's best-known novels are Beloved, about a slave after the Civil War, and Song of Solomon, which follows the life of an African-American man. 48 black writers had protested when Beloved failed to win a National Book Award, and just months later, it won the Pulitzer Prize. President Barack Obama awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012.
Toni reaches us deeply, using a tone that is lyrical, precise, distinct, and inclusive. Toni Morrison's prose brings us that kind of moral and emotional intensity that few writers ever attempt.
I'm Margie Zaraletta.
Pop star Ariana Grande let her fans know the wait is almost over, but she's not debuting a new song, rather Beauty in a Bottle. She tweeted that her new perfume, Thank You, Next, hit stores this month. Grande says it smells like summer at the beach. It's not her first fragrance. Her perfume Ari debuted in 2015. She describes that one as sweet and fruity with top notes of pear, grapefruit, and raspberries. Fans have been waiting for months to get their hands on her latest perfume. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
She grew from the drama. Only wanna do it once real bad. Call me the last. God forbid something happens. At least that song is a smash. I got so much love. Got so much patience. Learned from the pain. Turned out amazing. Left them all alone. But that's not what I see. Look what I found. No need for searching. We'll be right back.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA.